Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
So you may have read the two distressing columns by Nicholas Kristof in the New York Times over the last few days. If you did, you know they listed a growing body of evidence linking the misuse of antibiotics in farm animals and the spread of drug-resistant infections in people. It cited a study by the Union of Concerned Scientists, which showed that 70% of all antibiotics used in the United States, that's 70% of all antibiotics used in the U.S., go to healthy animals. Meanwhile, the antibiotic-resistant infection, MRSA, kills more than 18,000 Americans annually, more than AIDS does. But are these two facts related? Well, attempts to legislate away the misuse of antibiotics in farming have repeatedly been blocked by agribusiness interests. But this week, New York Congresswoman Louise Slaughter, who happens to be a microbiologist, the only one in Congress, plans to reintroduce legislation to ban the non-therapeutic use of antibiotics in farm animals and see what happens now that it's the Obama administration. To look at the issue with me now are New York Times columnist Nicholas Kristof and Roger Martin of the Pew Campaign on Human Health and Industrial Farming, which has also taken an extensive look at this issue. Nick, welcome back. Roger Martin, thanks for coming on WNYC today. Good morning.
My pleasure. Good morning.
Good morning, Brian.
And we'll also talk to Nick Kristof briefly about our guest last week, who was critical of his Darfur reporting, as you may remember from Friday's show. What's the point of giving antibiotics to healthy farm animals, Roger Martin? From a farmer's point of view, why is it done?
Well, it's done for primarily two reasons. Number one is the animals gain weight faster when they're taking antibiotics at daily lower levels. And they also, it keeps them healthy. It suppresses bacterial infections, does not kill the bacteria, but it suppresses infections because they're kept in very crowded, very unsanitary conditions. They stand over their own waste most of the day or in their own waste if they're chickens. And so it's those two reasons, growth promotion and suppressing bacterial infections.
Just very briefly, why does antibiotic use lead to faster growth? I understand the bacterial suppression. Why does that make animals grow?
Well, there's really differing opinions about that. I think the primary consensus is that when you feed antibiotics daily to an animal, their intestine walls weaken and they absorb nutrients faster, so it increases their growth rate.
And how does overuse of antibiotics in animals translate to a human health problem? Can you really prove any cause and effect?
Well, there's enough scientific evidence, the Pew Commission believed, to make that determination. As you said, 70% of the antibiotics used in the country are used in food animal production, and there's growing scientific evidence that shows that bacteria that have never come into contact with an antibiotic can absorb the resistance from bacteria that have. So tetracycline, for example, is regularly used in swine production in low levels. It's very important to human medicine. And so the swine develop like the staph infections that are fairly common in these facilities develop resistance to tetracycline and MRSA. So then the pigs, when they have the resistant bacteria, they can pass it on to workers who bring it to their back to their families. Or it's fairly persistent in the environment, in both groundwater, surface water, and in the soil.
But to be clear, on one point, there has been no reported case of anyone getting MRSA from eating meat, correct?
No, not from eating meat yet, but there are studies in the Netherlands and Canada that show that workers in these pig facilities have gotten sick from the pigs they're handling. So it's although there are also studies that show, I think the last study I saw was in Europe, but up to 49% of the meat purchased in supermarkets had MRSA contamination, but no one has gotten sick from ingesting it yet.
Nicholas Kristof, for people who didn't read your two columns on this over the last few days, tell us the story of the family doctor in Northwestern Indiana who you wrote about. Could you do that?
Sure. There's a little town in Indiana called Camden, population just a little more than 500, and there was a small one doctor in that town, a guy called Tom Anderson, and he kept encountering these puzzling cases of MRSA, this antibiotic-resistant staph infection in this little town, and it was a little unclear how many got it, but it seemed that it was equivalent to more than 10% of the population of the town. And he didn't know what was going on, but increasingly he began to think that there was a connection with the fact that this is hog country. The area is surrounded by these huge hog barns. And he sent some of the cultures off to be tested. He himself came down with MRSA, as did other members of his family. And he decided to blow the whistle, and he was willing to give an interview. I decided I wanted to go out because I was interested in the impact of feeding antibiotics to hogs, and then before I could interview him, he died of a heart attack, and so I did go out and talk to his nurse, to his wife, to his daughter, who had MRSA when I visited. Now, there's no proof that this huge outbreak of MRSA is resulting from these hogs in the area, but you have to wonder, and there is indeed a new strain of MRSA called ST398 that is strongly associated. It seems to be incubated by huge hog barns.
And you mentioned in your column that Europe and South Korea no longer allow the use of antibiotics in healthy animals. How do they prevent animals from getting sick?
They can, if an animal gets sick, then one can treat, one can use antibiotics, but they don't allow just the use of antibiotics as a non-therapeutic measure for all livestock. And I think that is the direction that we need to go. I mean, there are lots of reasons for the growth in antibiotic resistance, including the fact that human physicians overuse antibiotics, and I think that's generally accepted. But the fact that we have these vast quantities of antibiotics being used to help animals grow more quickly when it undermines our own health just seems completely wacky.
What would happen if the practice stopped, Nick? Is there not some downside?
Yeah, I mean, it would probably raise production costs. I spoke to the hog farmers, and they said that probably you would see some increased pig mortality. They also say that you would probably see more therapeutic use of antibiotics for animals that became sick, less weight gain, and from their point of view, there's higher costs of production. But there are huge external costs in, you know, the health of you and me and everybody else when we undermine the antibiotics and their ability to fight infections.
We can take a few phone calls for New York Times columnist Nicholas Kristof and Roger Martin from the Pew Campaign on Human Health and Industrial Farming. I don't know if we have any farmers or former farmers listening here in the New York City area today who want to talk about the practice, do a little whistleblowing of your own, or anyone else. 212-433-WNYC if you want to ask a question or make a comment about this topic, which could theoretically affect a lot more people than it does now, and there are predictions that may be likely. Roger Martin, tell us about this legislation being introduced by New York Congresswoman Louise Slaughter.
Yes, it's called the Preservation of Antibiotics for Medical Treatment Act, or PAMTA is the acronym, and it would ban the seven most important human antibiotics from use in routine animal production. Interestingly enough, in 1978, the Center for Veterinary Medicine of the FDA started to move in this direction to ban the non-therapeutic use of these important antibiotics back then, at about the same time that the movement was taking place in
in human medicine to reduce the use, unnecessary use of antibiotics, and it was stopped by Congress. It's still an open rule at the FDA, but it was stopped by Congress because of, I believe, the influence of the agro-industrial complex in the country. And PAMTA is the legislative remedy for that block rulemaking. It's been, I think, Congresswoman Slaughter had it in the last Congress, in the 110th Congress, and I believe in the 109th Congress as well. So it's a renewed effort on her part. And as you said in your introduction, she's the only microbiologist in the Congress, and it's something that's concerned her very much. I would say one thing, too, about the cost. The CDC, or I guess it's actually the Institute of Medicine at the National Academies of Science, has said that antibiotic resistance as of 1998 was costing the economy about $5 billion a year. Mm-hmm. So there is a current cost to the overuse of these antibiotics, using them as a crutch in these unsanitary or overcrowded facilities just to keep the animals healthy. So PAMTA, and I believe President Obama has said he supports PAMTA, so we might actually see some movement now.
Interesting. Andrew in Brooklyn used to work on a chicken farm, right, Andrew?
Well, it was a small farm in Saranac. It was called the New Land Trust.
Uh-huh.
We raised chicks, and basically we'd get a bunch of them. If we didn't feed them antibiotics, they would just die. Like, the whole population would just die.
Is there
healthy, though.
Is there a difference here between pigs, which you've been talking about mostly, Nicholas Kristof, and chickens or other animals with respect to this practice?
Well, I mean, I grew up on farms, and we raised at various points, you know, pigs and chickens. I mean, very modest. This is a incredibly inefficient, chaotic farm. But we certainly didn't feed antibiotics to any chicken of our animals.
Well, Andrew, what leads you to believe that they would have died en masse without feeding them antibiotics when they were healthy?
I actually did. They actually would. You know, we lost half of our population.
To what? Do you know?
No, we didn't have the animals tested or anything, but they, you know, we lost literally half of them, so we regimented them with, like, mackerel and antibiotics, and they survived, and then after adulthood, you know, they're healthy, so we just stopped, you know.
At that point.
Yeah. One measure of what is possible is the fact that, indeed, we have seen antibiotics controlled for this use in Europe, starting with Sweden, then Denmark, and then now all of Europe has barred the routine non-therapeutic use of antibiotics in animal feed, and chickens there are still living. Hogs are still being grown. There is indeed more antibiotics being used therapeutically to treat sick animals, but overall, agriculture is certainly very viable in Europe.
John in Putnam Valley raised pigs without antibiotics. Is that right, John?
Yeah, we raised about 300 sows a week using free-range methods, which we then sold to local farms and in farmers' market.
And was it much more expensive to do it that way?
It ranged, depending on the pig, but it ranged about 60 to 80 cents more per pound to raise it without antibiotics.
What about disease rates?
We found that our pigs, not only living happier lives, had very few encounters of disease or problems.
John, thank you. And Claire in Queens, you're on WNYC.
Yes,
hi, Claire.
Thank you. I have known this for a long time because I think even in the 50s they talked about it, but I'm allergic to penicillin. What are the chances that I've been getting sick, physically sick from eating boar's head ham, and I'd like to know what the possibility is of checking up on whether or not...
Claire, thank you. What about that? If people are allergic to the antibiotics that are being routinely used on these healthy animals, could it be transmitted in the meat in such a way to cause a reaction?
Well, I'm not a medical doctor, but I think that is somewhat unlikely. I mean, the CDC does have very strong guidelines about, you know, thoroughly cook the meat, clean up the counter in your kitchen when you're done. So it's almost being treated as a hazardous material. But I'm not sure the real threat is from eating meat laced with penicillin. I think it's really more the environmental exposure, and since bacteria don't know geographic boundaries. I mean, it is something that people in New York should be concerned about.
It's the growth of the antibiotic-resistant strains of these bacteria in the environment, right? It's not that we would be able to measure, although maybe they do, I don't know, Nicholas, maybe you know, measure levels of tetracycline or other antibiotics in the human body just from consuming meat. Do you know?
That I don't know.
It's really the creation of these antibiotic-resistant strains in the environment, which can then attack people.
Yeah, I mean, one concern is that if you are in the vicinity of hog farms, then you may indeed get something like this new strain of, right, of MERS ST398. I think more broadly for the population as a whole, it is the question of getting sick, yeah, from meat, although that's still very theoretical. We really don't know what that risk is. And more broadly, that even that anybody at all gets sick with some kind of antibiotic-resistant organism, and then all of a sudden the medicines don't work.
Now, as kind of a tag to this, I want to ask you about one other thing, Nicholas Kristof, before you go.
Sure.
Having to do with a completely other subject, and that is Darfur, on which you have reported so extensively. And by the way, I see that you've picked your latest Win a Trip to Africa winner from the University of South Carolina. I remember when you came on the show with the previous winner before your trip and after your trip, to see what that student had learned, and I hope we can do that again. But on Friday, we had Columbia University professor Mahmoud Mamdani, author of a new book about Darfur, in which he says it's not genocide and that the West is exaggerating the crisis for its own purposes, including the media, even after statistics were released that contradicted what the Save Darfur movement claims. I asked him about your reporting, and we had this exchange, or this,
sure,
is part of his answer in which he mentions you by name.
How come that even after the Government Accountability Office pointed out, and the State Department agreed, this is all on the website now, that Save Darfur estimates were simply not tenable? One of the Save Darfur researchers, Hagen, actually revised his estimates, but Save Darfur did not. It continued with signs in New York subway, 400,000 dead, 400,000 plus dead. So why? My answer is simply that people like Nicholas Kristof and others who were involved in Save Darfur were basically involved in it regardless of what was happening in Darfur.
Why?
Darfur was a feel-good issue. Darfur was a feel-good issue, and they had removed Darfur from any politics, any history. I thought of Senator Fulbright when he wrote his book called Arrogance of Power, which is when people are so powerful, they don't really care what the facts are on the ground. They simply pursue and proceed with their own point of view until they are checked by facts on the ground.
Nicholas Kristof, any reaction to Professor Mamdani? He says the,
sure,
Government Accountability Office exploded the myth of 400,000 dead, for example.
There have been about 10 or a dozen mortality estimates that I know of, careful estimates for the losses in Darfur, and they're all pretty bad estimates. We don't have any real ability to make good estimates until there is calm there and we can send in teams to do better mortality estimates. I use hundreds of thousands. I don't use the 400,000 number because, you know, we just don't know. So the GAO study was one, but there are lots of different studies. The University of Chicago has come up with higher numbers. We don't have good figures there. In terms of the broader question, I mean, I've been to Darfur and the surrounding area 10 times, and the criticism that I think Professor Mamdani makes is essentially that it's complicated, you know, that it's more than it seems. And I think that there, you know, is indeed something to that. It is, genocide is always complex, and it was complicated in the Holocaust. It was complicated in Cambodia. It was complicated in Rwanda. But at the end of the day, what you see in Darfur and what you've also now seen in Chad is groups of government-sponsored, government-paid militias going around and choosing people on the basis of race and the tribe they belong to and throwing their babies into bonfires. And I think that that is the fundamental truth that you know, will be taken away and that people will write about, just as the fundamental truth we take away from the very complicated Holocaust was a government targeting people on the basis that they were Jews, or in Rwanda, people targeted on the basis that they were Tutsi. And so, you know, yes, it's complicated. Yes, there are layers and layers and a deep history, but I think that we're right to focus on what a government has done in targeting people on the basis of race and ethnicity.
He also wrote, by the way, that if we really cared about the worst situation in the world, we'd all be talking about northern Uganda with maybe 2 million refugees, to which he says Darfur pales in comparison. Have you heard that argument?
Not so much about northern Uganda. It's certainly true about Congo. I mean, northern Uganda now is also it's been slightly improved, but I mean, northern Uganda was a real mess, but Congo was far greater in terms of mortality, mm-hmm. and I wondered about that. But you know, Congo, you had greater mortality, but it wasn't a genocide. It wasn't a government choosing people on the basis of what tribe they belonged to kill them. And that is what was happening in Darfur, and it seemed to me that merited a special spotlight.
Now, Roger Martin from the Pew Center, I'll go back to you for one final question on antibiotics and meat. You know, the progressive food community was very disappointed with the appointment of Tom Vilsack as agriculture secretary. They say he's just the kind that's in the pocket of agribusiness. Are you disappointed? Do you think he will try to block the reforms you've been advocating? And we have 30 seconds left.
Well, I don't think so. I mean, he was not very progressive on these issues when he was governor of Iowa, but he is now representing the entire country, and he's President Obama's Secretary of Agriculture. A deputy secretary nominee, Kathleen Merrigan, is very well known. She's at Tufts University now, very well known in the sustainable community. And the real key is Margaret Hamburg, who's been nominated at the FDA. I mean, if the FDA rule would move through from their Center of Veterinary Medicine, you really wouldn't need this legislative action.
Uh-huh.
And she was known in New York as a very strong public health commissioner when she was there. So
they could still do it on the level of rulemaking.
Yes, they could.
Interesting.
I mean, it may take a legislative action eventually anyway, just to be safe so it couldn't be overturned easily.
Right.
But, yeah, so I'm optimistic.
By the way, I've been calling you Roger Martin. Is your real first name Robert?
Yes, it is.
My apologies.
I go by Bob, so.
My apologies. Bob
That's
Martin.
All right.
Robert Martin from the Pew Campaign on Human Health and Industrial Farming. Nicholas Kristof, that's your name, right?
No, I'm Roger, actually.
New York Times columnist. And one final note, tonight at 10, HBO is airing a documentary on a related issue. It's called Death on a Factory Farm, and it follows an undercover animal rights activist who filmed abuse at a hog farm. Thanks to both of you for joining us today.
Hey, thanks, Brian.
And coming up in a minute, Hannah Rosen in defense of not breastfeeding. Women want to call in right now, whether you're breastfeeding or not, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692.